Hi, I'm Ahmed Shahabuddin, filling in for Femi Okay on the stream this week and bringing you this week's bonus edition of the show. Coming up, I'll take you behind the scenes for extra coverage of forced evictions happening in India, as well as a conversation about the activist economy. But first, this year, we witnessed a significant shift in public opinion across the world, really, when it comes to Palestine, fueled in large part by the violence in Gaza war this past May. And after the show on Monday, our conversation continued with rapper Lowkey and activist Linda Sarsour. I started out by playing a statement from award-winning musician John Legend, affirming the rights of Palestinians to live in dignity, to journalist Mehdi Hassan. And then we discussed the role of celebrity in the growing movement. Have a listen.
When I see what's happening in Palestine to the Palestinian people, where they're clearly not being able to experience the full rights that they deserve, and it's an extremely unfair and difficult life they're forced to live, I had to say something. It's not fair, it's not just, and given that Israel is the recipient of so much American aid and support and is named as one of our strongest allies, we should hold them to a higher standard. And what they're doing with the Palestinian people is not fair, and it shouldn't be done in our name and with our resources contributing to it.
Lowkey, I mean, you know, as someone who, you know, also is an artist, makes music, I mean, you see someone like John Legend, you know, say something that, I guess, it's not that bold and kind of inflammatory, and yet when I watched it live, I was kind of like, what's happening? Is this really okay? And, you know, because it's so rare. And I wonder if you think that if there are more celebrities with their followings that speak kind of as directly as he does, saying not only should we hold Israel accountable, but to a higher standard. What do you make of that comment? But also, is that useful in changing things?
Yes, it's useful, but it's also a product of bottom-up pressure. Growth always comes from the bottom up. You have the National Union of Students in this country that have a BDS, passed the BDS motion. You have the largest trade union in this country, Unite, passed the BDS motion in 2010, yet the leadership of the union are yet to implement it, despite its membership being clear about what it wants. With celebrities, they are also receptive to that kind of push from below, and it's essential that that continues. And as you see more people within society demanding it, you will also see those within the public eye speak out a bit more. Israel obviously has a keen understanding of how to kind of disfigure the perception of BDS through its proxies, and it has organizations not only in the US. This is an organization that Linda Sarsour knows all about, the Anti-Defamation League. In 1969, the FBI had an internal memo that questioned whether the ADL was in violation of the Registration of Foreign Agents Act because of how close it was to the Israeli government. And what you have seen really is it use this cover of racial justice to fight against BDS, to try and disfigure this demand for Palestinian rights as somehow being rooted in some form of racism. But you also have organizations in this country who closely work, according to the trustees report of the Board of Deputies, this organization put in its own report that it works closely with the Israeli embassy, that it has strengthened links with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and with the IDF. This organization is an anti-BDS organization. And clearly, unfortunately, within the media, a lot of these organizations are taken at face value instead of looked at more critically.
And Linda, you know, he talked about being rooted in racism. You know, just to quote one small part of this article that I referenced in the live TV part of the show, Rafael Mimoun talked, Linda, about how Jewish attitudes on Zionism are changing. He said it's something that really struck me. I don't know, maybe it's just me. Zionism is rooted in trauma and fear. It's about survival and love of the Jewish people, but like any other ethnic nationalism, Zionism establishes a hierarchy. It's about prioritizing our safety and well-being, even at the expense of others. It relies on an alternate historical narrative. At a time when for 4 years we've struggled with all these alternative narratives and alternative facts, and I just think this is such a salient point because, you know, change always comes best from within. So I've always wondered, even as a kid, when I saw this injustice, and Linda, I wonder your thoughts, like, is Palestine, or will there be liberation for Palestinian people so long as this aspect of kind of Zionism is not addressed amongst Jewish people? I know Loki's made the point of distinction between how many people who are Jewish who live in Israel versus Jewish people across the world, like 60 million versus, I think, 6 million. How critical is this aspect of the argument to you?
It's extremely critical in order for us to get true liberation and freedom in Palestine, in historic Palestine. We need Jewish people to be on board with that, to understand that our liberation as Arab people, as Palestinian people, as Jewish people is intertwined, and that one cannot be free without the other. And you cannot build a nation state that is supposed to promise safety and security for one people at the expense of another people. And when you have these conversations, mm-hmm. I've had them with young people in college campuses across America, mm-hmm. amongst Jewish organizers, and even folks who say that they tell me, oh, I love Israel, but I don't like what Israel's doing. And I have these conversations with them. They too have been fed a long narrative, and now they're at a place where they can't deny reality. So when now you have organizations like B'Tselem, who's calling Israel an apartheid state,
right.
You're having groups like Human Rights Watch put out reports of hundreds of pages of why Israel is an apartheid state,
right.
Having more members of parliament in the UK and other European nations, including here, of course, in Congress, calling Israel an apartheid state, calling it ethnic cleansing, is really starting to get to a point where a lot of our Jewish allies, and even those who are not, you know, super right-wing Zionists, but consider themselves to be what they call progressive Zionists, to say, wait a minute, I can't really put my name on this.
Right.
You know, yes, this is apartheid. This is not what we support. And
right.
So that's why this conversation is important, and the reckoning is happening amongst a lot of these Jewish organizations and pro-Israel organizations, and really amongst their young people. And that's what gives me hope.
And when we talk about hope, we got to wrap up in a couple of seconds here, Loki, mm-hmm. but I want to come to you. You know, we've seen Rashida Tlaib get reelected here in the U.S. We saw Ilhan Omar get reelected despite all the things she said, you know, in support of Palestine and critically of Israel. Betty McCollum, who introduced the bill to condition military aid. Every time, you know, someone shows that actually you can do it and your political career can be fine relative to their districts, and you see Labour delegates sparking a row in the UK with the party's leadership by demanding sanctions against Israel for its apartheid policies. I mean, do you think this really is a watershed moment where we're going to see more and more of this, or is it like two steps forward, one step back?
Unfortunately, the Labour Party has a leadership which describes itself as an unqualified a supporter of Zionism without qualification. You have he's funded by Trevor Chin, who is an Israel lobbyist. You know, in the United States, you have the Democrats giving $10.4 million per day to the Israeli state. So, of course, these are massive, massive limitations that we're talking about. The Palestinians will liberate themselves. Of course, it would be helpful if the United States and Britain can stop collaborating in their suppression and oppression. And, you know, the vital point at the end of the day is for us here in diaspora and in the rest of the world is to plant seeds for trees that we might not sit in the shade of. Because while they say that resistance is futile, we say no, resistance is fertile.
Now, sticking with that celebrity activism angle, I want to share a recent behind-the-scenes conversation between Femi Oke and a panel of activists. Femi wanted to know if they could pick one celebrity activist to work with, who would it be?
I thought about this a lot, and I think for us, it would be Jane Fonda. You know, I think of her as truly someone who embodies celebrity with activism. Every time she has lent her voice, she's done it with truth and passion. I think about the way that she is rallying for climate change now and, you know, promises to never buy another piece of clothing and goes out there and gets arrested. And she just continues to use her platform for good. And so Jane Fonda would be my top choice.
Lisa. I was also wondering how many pieces of clothing Joan Nori has. I mean, she's probably already beat most of us. I think I'd love to partner with Kumi, actually, because I think it would be really amazing to partner with somebody who has so much experience and actual leadership in terms of leading the most important fights that we have today, which I completely agree are the fights for our right to exist on this planet, each and every one of us. So leading an anti-racist policy, which is fully based in environmentalism, fully based in democracy, in people actually learning to live together on this planet that we all share, I think he would be a fantastic high-profile partner.
Thank you, Lisa. My vote goes to Aisha, first to Jane Fonda, just to say I would vote for her. I want to come back to Lisa's. And then in Africa, I can pick a range of people, but Angelique Kidjo,
yes,
from Benin.
Friend of the stream, an extraordinary woman.
That is a framework for education, school, religion, and most powerfully, the framework for communications and media that is heavily stacked against activism. And therefore, I think we have to recognize when we are talking about such a short time span to turn things around, that we on our side have to be more creative to, while we make sure that the celebrities don't go crazy on us, right? We need to find ways in which we can draw the energy and help them amplify the messages of justice that we critically need to do to a very large audience, much more than we are able to reach at the moment.
Totally.
And Femi, that would be great if you could have a celebrity that came into the room and actually could use their charisma to actually hold the audience, where visionary leaders who actually, you know, as you talked about, you know, who are involved in the activist movement, as both of you are, then could actually talk about what your own agenda would be for change, as opposed to particularly launching certain kinds of products and supporting the agendas, which are based in these kind of celebrity strategic partnerships, which is to try to bring certain items onto the agenda because they're more photogenic or because they're more attractive.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
And I'm one of the folks who were like a big yikes when it comes to that activist show, right? Because one of the things is, as activists, we're constantly fighting against multi-billion dollar corporations. And then here you are pitting activists against one another to fight for money. When we know in activist circles, the number one thing we need to do is show solidarity and to collaborate. So when it becomes that kind of education that's more entertainment, you know, edutainment, as they say, that's when it becomes dangerous, you know. And so I'm glad that that show isn't going to go online, because it would really do more harm than good. Much as, you know, what's been said around Bell product, it's not going to help us.
Wasn't that competitive element, however, like the one true thing about the activists, the fact that today NGOs and active organizations have to compete for
donor
very
funds.
Little funding?
Yeah.
Where in the past there used to be much more regular funding from donors, and now activists have to be able to have extremely photogenic beneficiaries. They have to have, you know, all sorts of reports and strategic outcomes, you know, at the level of a Harvard-trained economist. And then they also have to have celebrities to actually get some media space and attention. Sounds like a terrible world to have to compete in.
So, guess I have one more ask of you, and that is, in this equation, not only do we have the important crisis that we have to face as a global community, we also have people who want to do good, who want to help, and they're not too sure what to do. What should they look out for? What are the warning signs? Where should they volunteer? Where should they contribute? What should they do? Lisa, you have a lot of answers. You start. Just very briefly. One thought.
Yeah. Yeah. If somebody's selling you something, you should be suspicious of that, because we don't need more things. And second of all, there are lots of things people can do to be involved. I mean, I would never say there's not such a thing as a need for an activist involvement. You can also celebrate basic things like paying your taxes, voting in politicians that are willing to support
paying
an anti-racist agenda, global health care.
Okay.
Absolutely. You know, I live in a social democrat state, but, you know, it does work.
Aisha.
At Remake, you know, we're here to train a generation of change makers that you're not going to buy your way into a sustainable fashion future. You know, it's about buying less, buying better, and really coming into your activism self. We're having to retrain young people to call policymakers, as we did for this bill, to light up their phones. And so there are plenty of ways, and our organization really tries to make it inclusive and accessible. Using your voice, there's so much more than people realize.
And Kumi.
I just want to say what Aisha's doing in her work is very inspirational to me. I hope many people listening to this will support it. Lisa, I endorse what she said in these last comments here. I think that we need to create a context where there's enough space for everybody to participate, but where we participate as equals, and each of us might bring different skills to it. I might bring strategic planning, civil disobedience, certain communication skills, and so on. Somebody else who's connected to the media because they're a celebrity might be able to open up space. Now, yes, maybe the first interview, they go and do it on their own. But what stops a celebrity from saying to a media outlet, I'm not going to do any interviews with you unless the two or three key people in this movement for this cause are with me in those interviews. So they can use their voice to lift up the voices that need to be heard. The truth is, we don't need to hear more and more voices of celebrities. But celebrities can use their voice to help pick up other people's voices. And of course, they're going to have to use their own voice as well. I'm not saying they don't. But at the end of the day, I think today I would appeal to celebrities as human beings, but mostly as parents, right? To those celebrities who are parents, you need to recognize that your children's lives and your grandchildren's lives are as much at risk as our children's lives and so on, right? And therefore, use your power of public presence in a responsible way, in a humble way, in a strategic way, and don't ever use that power in a way that breeds more consumption that we don't need, or which actually elevates your own status and undermines the status of activists or their movements.
Thousands of people in northeastern India have been evicted in a controversial move by the government, and it led to a conversation that our guests weren't ready to have end. Here's what they had to say after our broadcast.
That was their manifesto. It was in BJP's manifesto. And they had been doing what they have promised. There is no gray area in between. The BJP has said whatever they have said, it's in black and white. And they are doing what they have said. And actually, BJP is not an hypocrite party.
What they are doing is problematic.
It might look problematic from the other end if you look
in a very different way.
Please, Joy, it looks problematic. Let's see why he thinks it looks problematic. Abdul Kalam, make your point.
Of course.
Yes, you see, when large number of people are getting displaced because of erosion, it is the government responsibility to rehabilitate them. Here, they are not rehabilitating. Rather, they are, taking over those lands.
Do you have any evidence to say that they have not rehabilitated?
We're gonna get another perspective, maybe a voice of reason. I mean, Jury may be rightfully questioning about the evidence, and Abdul Kalam says he has the evidence. Kaustubh, what is the motivation in your mind behind these evictions? And is Abdul Kalam right when he says that there is evidence that they have not been properly rehabilitating families that have been made homeless?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that eviction has always been a politically charged subject in Assam. And it's been, in fact, one of the main driver of politics in Assam. And not only regarding the Muslims, but the tribals versus non-tribals. The first eviction started with the tribals of Assam from the forest. So that way, we should not just begin with the present BJP regime, but see it as a kind of a continuation of a narrative. So that way, the flawed land policy, I'll go back again and again to that. There is a flawed land policy. We don't have enough land record. There is a lot of, complexities involved in that, because of which it is difficult. The rehabilitation runs into trouble because of that. Mm-hmm. And, in Assam, the...
Mr. Deka, would you now agree that the BJP government has started reformation of land law? Will you just agree to that this government has the intention of, reforming the land laws, and they have come into the enforcement of a mission called Vasundhara, which will be very difficult to understand right now.
And what they're doing is that they're evicting the Muslims.
And Mr. Deka, I think you must in agree.
Jury?
Mr. Kalam, why he is always targeting the word called Muslim? The eviction has been done in, even in
Jury, you asked Kaustab a question. Please respond to Jury.
I would like to answer that. No, I do agree that there are definite attempts at the reformation, you can say, or change of land laws and this Tenancy Act and all that. But my contention is that, that is where we should focus again, is that it is to do with the nature of political economy. It is to do with the nature of quote-unquote development that the state is embarking on, right? And it need not necessarily be something very positive or something very welcoming, but this is a neoliberal state and the land disposition rate is very high. And it is basically all belonging to, say, scheduled tribes or scheduled castes or other marginalized communities. And this is something that we are witnessing all over northeast of India, where this development is going in a very fast scale.
To at least accuse the BJP of focusing or targeting Muslims of Bengali origin? Or do you disagree that that's not fair? Jury, 1 second, please.
See, I mean, regarding this particular issue, if we just reduce it to the targeting of Bengali Muslim, it will be a lopsided view of the larger thing.
Of course,
of course. But of course, I agree that perhaps if you see it politically as part of the larger agenda, that's a different debate.
Right, and obviously that's a debate for another time. But Jury, that's what I was referring to about trying to maybe maintain a majority that is not Muslim. Yeah. In not only the last election, but also the previous elections and future elections.
See, BJP has not targeted the Muslims. I have been telling that from the very beginning. It is the BJP who has been actually in favor of the indigenous Assamese people. When we call indigenous Assamese people, we have to look at the history of Assam, which goes well back from 1200, 206 BC. Because the Assamese people might have forgotten about the King Prithvi. Prithu, who has actually fought the Battle of Kilauea. And since that time, there has been a lot of immigration. And if you look at the origin of Assam, the Muslim culture has developed within Assam without any boundaries. And that there have been never, if you call Assamese as a society, we cannot, apart or differentiate ourselves from the Muslims. Because the Assamese Muslim and the Hindu Muslim...
Unfortunately, even the Assamese Muslims are also... Jury, let's just give him... Okay, Abdul Kalam, they are trying to get a sympathy.
The real immigrant Muslims, I don't call them immigrant Muslims, immigrant Bengalis, they have been trying to get a sympathy over the international arena. And in Assam, we call them actually Pauwas.
But Jury, I want to give Abdul Kalam a chance to tell us what he thinks so unfortunate. He said unfortunately, but... for as much as they may, I would just share on a human level, if I was being made homeless in a pandemic, I don't know that I would have to try very hard to gain sympathy. I think people would empathize with me because it's an unfortunate situation for anyone to find themselves in.
I'm not talking about the eviction right now during the pandemic situation.
Okay.
I'm talking about the way Kalam has been talking about BJP being targeting the Muslims, which I actually disagree.
Okay, so she disagrees. Abdul Kalam, I'll give you the last word. What were you saying when you said it's unfortunate?
Because she'll have to disagree, I understand. But unfortunate is that, number one, even in that particular area, we have SMS media reported that even the Muslim of indigenous origin, they are also facing eviction. Number two, what Kostov has mentioned, that he was trying to be very careful of not making controversial comment. That is what I understand. But what we see on ground is that in eviction, yes, there are evictions where non-Muslims are also getting evicted.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see the difference, please allow me to make this point uninterrupted. If you see the difference is that in case of Muslims, you find that this where eviction against Muslims, you will find it. This is communally sourced. You will see dehumanization.
That's our show for today. Thanks for watching and see you next time.